So this is a discussion about money and politics, which obviously my book is all about. And I wanted to start off by talking about a book that I just finished. The book I'm reading now is called Honest Graft, which is about Tammany Hall in New York City at the turn of the century. And in 1903, journalist William Reardon published this book as a series of interviews with George Washington Plunkett, probably the most famous leader of New York's Tammany Hall other than Boss Tweed himself. And in an interchange where Plunkett discusses Lincoln Steffens' then newly published book, The Shame of the City, Plunkett tells Reardon that Steffens, quote, can't see no difference between honest graft and dishonest graft, and consequently, he gets things all mixed up. Now, I would say the same thing could be said for the current Congress. Honest graft, said Plunkett, is when the politician looks after his own interests, his organization's interests, and the people's interests all at the same time. Think, for instance, the creation of Social Security. It served Franklin Delano Roosevelt's political interests. It served the Democratic Party's interests. And I think we'd all agree it serves the people's interests. Dishonest graft, by contrast, is engaged in by, quote, looters, who go in for themselves alone without considering their organization or the people, according to Plunkett. Now, I would say you think about Tom DeLay and the Jack Abramoff scandal. As the Associated Press reported last year, the Abramoff-DeLay relationship made DeLay, quote, a king of campaign fundraising, allowing him to visit clifftop Caribbean resorts, golf courses designed by PGA champions and four-star restaurants, all courtesy of donors who bankrolled his political money empire. That was the AP. In the process, DeLay helped pass energy legislation that gave away taxpayer money to already wealthy energy companies and tax legislation that gave away taxpayer money to millionaires, all while creating a scandal that eventually broke his party's hold on Congress. That's dishonest graft. But in a certain sense, the latter form of corruption is the purest form of honest graft. The Republican Party today really doesn't pretend to be anything other than the party of big money. And it never has, at least not in the modern age. Take the famous K Street Project, for instance. We all remember that, right, during the campaign ads, the K Street Project. This was an operation designed by Republican congressmen to use the promises of access and the threat of no access to force corporate lobbying organizations in Washington to fire Democratic lobbyists and hire Republicans so that those new Republican lobbyists could siphon in their jobs as much corporate campaign contributions as possible to Republican political candidates. Now, had this operation performed its work in secret, one might be able to say that Republicans at least publicly tried to pretend they were something they were not. And there were, of course, some Republican lawmakers like Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, one of the chief architects of the K Street Project inside of Congress, who actually told his local newspaper he had never been involved in the project and barely knew about it. But that was more the exception, really, than the rule, as the K Street Project actually had its own public website, bragging to the world about its very open pay-to-play scheme. In fact, I think the K Street Project's website still exists. You can go Google it. Now, to me, this is honest graft. So this is honest graft. This is being open and honest about what the American Heritage Dictionary defines as graft, the unscrupulous use of one's position to derive profit or advantages. The Republican Congress didn't make any serious effort to pretend to be anything else. And in holding on to Congress for 12 years, the Republicans made the same successful calculation that George Washington Plunkett did back at the turn of the 20th century, or the 19th century. They believed that honest graft doesn't, quote, hurt Tammany with the people if the people perceive it to be open, public, and merely a small, necessary, and innocuous cost of the government doing business. Now, clearly, this formula ran out after 6 years of one-party control of Congress and the White House. And the American people started to see how big, wasteful, and destructive Republican corruption really was, and how it wasn't just a harmless cost. With Democrats running populist economic campaigns all over the country against corruption, the public began connecting the challenges we all face in our daily lives with the spiraling corruption going on in Washington. Republicans' refusal, for instance, to rein in the energy industry at the same time lawmakers were raking in campaign cash from oil companies began to be connected in our minds with high gas prices. Congress's refusal to move forward on any health care initiative whatsoever, at the same time both parties were pocketing huge campaign contributions from HMOs and the health insurance industry, began to be connected in people's minds with out-of-control health care premiums. The White House's official endorsement of job outsourcing, official endorsement. At the same time President Bush was raising money from multinational corporate outsourcers, began to be connected in people's mind with their job insecurity and their decreasing wages. Democrats rode the populist anti-corruption platform that they put out there for the public to a victory in 2006, which I think was good. But the problem is we're now starting to see what we may have on our hands is merely a transfer from honest graft to dishonest graft. That is, corrupt behavior that pretends to be done in the people's name and that flies in the face of what we were promised just months ago. Let me give you some examples. This is a story that ran in the Associated Press. Quote, House Democrats are suddenly balking at the tough lobbying reforms they touted to voters last fall as a reason for putting them in charge of Congress. Now that they're running things, many Democrats want to keep the big campaign donations and lavish parties that lobbyists put together for them. They're also having second thoughts about having to wait an extra year before they can become high-paid lobbyists themselves should they retire or be defeated at the polls. The growing resistance to several proposed reforms, said the Associated Press, now threatens passage of a bill that once seemed on track to fulfill Democrats' campaign promise of cleaner fundraising and lobbying practices. To put this story in some context, this story came out the very same day a handful of Democratic congressional leaders held a press conference to trumpet a so-called deal with the Bush administration to push forward a package of lobbyist-written trade deals, the very exact same kind of international trade deals 100 of their 2006 candidates said they would work to stop if elected to Congress. Though Democrats weekly said they had secured basic labor and environmental standards in these deals, the Bush-connected head of the United States Chamber of Commerce told reporters that he had been given, quote, assurances that the labor provisions in the deal cannot be read to require compliance. Those two stories happened in the same day. And big shock, of course, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce's quote was reported by one paper in the United States, and that was it. The Wall Street Journal buried in its story. That's a separate issue about the media. Now, Congressman Rahm Emanuel gives us a very good example of the dishonest graft that we're talking about here in the new Congress. In 1993, Emanuel was the Clinton administration aide charged with ramming NAFTA through Congress, quote, over the dead bodies of labor and environmental groups, as American Express's CEO cheered at the time. Emanuel orchestrated weekly meetings with K Street lobbyists to strategize about how to pressure Democratic lawmakers into not blocking the NAFTA agreement. He went on to cash in as an investment banker, making roughly $16 million over a two-year period, despite having spent his entire career in government or in political campaigns. From his Wall Street perch in 2000, he published a scathing Wall Street Journal op-ed demanding Congress pass the China Free Trade Deal, another deal with no labor, human rights, or environmental standards. Another K Street-backed goodie that has helped keep American wages stagnating in the faces of skyrocketing corporate profits, a deal that is now projected to destroy net 1 million American jobs, according to the Economic Policy Institute. This is a deal that has helped drive our wages, our environmental standards, our human rights into the ground. That's the key with trade deals. Remember that. If you force American workers to compete with slave labor with a country, with any country that has no environmental standards, you put a premium on lower wages, worse environmental standards, worse human rights abuses. That becomes an economic premium. Now, just 2 years after Rahm Emanuel grossly outspent an opponent to buy, essentially, an Illinois congressional seat, he was appointed, if you can believe it, to the House Ways and Means Committee, the panel that oversees trade policy and that he helped corporate lobbyists ram NAFTA through back in 1993. This is the Democratic Party that put him on the Ways and Means Committee. Emanuel was also appointed to head the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, which ran millions of dollars worth of ads trumpeting Democratic candidates' anti-corruption platform, their platforms for trade deals that actually have labor, environmental, and human rights standards in it, and which supported all sorts of populist Democrats across the country. Now we see the effects of this. Rahm Emanuel is now chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, and we see the dishonest graft kick in the high gear. A group of House Democrats wrote a formal letter to Emanuel demanding he hold a Democratic caucus meeting to discuss this secret trade deal that was being negotiated between a handful of Democrats and the Bush administration. That letter, according to the Hill newspaper, was, quote, rebuffed, even though, again, it was Emanuel's own campaign committee that aggressively supported Democrats' 2006 fair trade campaigns. No meeting occurred, and instead, Democratic leaders, hours after the letter had been received, held a press conference announcing this secret trade deal that, like NAFTA, is strongly backed by corporate lobbyists, opposed by organized labor, environmental groups, healthcare groups, small farmer groups, and religious groups, and grassroots Democrats. Meanwhile, when Emanuel was asked by the Politico newspaper for details about why Democrats were now backing off their promises at the same time to reform lobbying laws so as to prevent the Abramoff-style abuses that Democrats promised they would prevent, he did his best Dick Cheney impression by telling the reporter to go f*** yourself. That's a direct quote. Running a campaign against corruption, against lobbyist-written trade policies, and for lobbying reform, and then using the power granted by voters based on that campaign to engage in corruption, pass lobbyist-written trade pacts, and reject the most minimal lobbying reforms, all in exchange for a massive amount of campaign contributions, is Plunkett's very definition of dishonest graft. It is political looting, and it's the result of a hostile takeover, I would argue, of the Democratic Party by big money interests. But maybe we shouldn't be surprised. It's no secret that Democrats have a very powerful faction within their ranks that is perfectly happy engaging in the same kind of pay-to-play corruption that Republicans have engaged in. It was, for example, Minority Whip Steny Hoyer who bragged on his taxpayer-funded official website about starting his own K Street project in 2003, and whose top legislative aide moonlighted as his political action committee's top K Street and Wall Street fundraiser. It was a corporate-funded group known as the Democratic Leadership Council that continues to push for lobbyist-written trade deals that include no basic labor, human rights, or environmental standards. In fact, that group has labeled those basic standards as isolationist and protectionist. Meanwhile, trade deals, which are thousands of pages long, which include scores and scores and scores of provisions protecting corporate profits, like copyrights, drug patents, intellectual property, that's we're supposed to basically consider free trade. Any protections for human beings, the planet Earth, anything else like that, that's protectionist. You're an isolationist if you support those. And it's the same thing with Democratic presidential candidates who engage in the culture of corruption as if it was one of the many tests they need to pass to win the Democratic primary. Hillary Clinton, for instance, talks a lot about helping the middle class. Yet as the number one Senate recipient of health care cash, I want to repeat that, the number one Senate recipient of health care industry cash, more than any Republican or any other Democrat. She now has given speeches apologizing for ever trying to push universal health care in the past. She employs as her top campaign strategist now a pollster who moonlights at the very same time as the CEO of one of the largest corporate PR firms in the world, a firm that helps companies, that brags about helping companies on its website, union bust. Barack Obama, he's been caught skirting his own much bragged about ban on taking money from lobbyists. Business Week reports that both of these candidates have asked Wall Street executives, many of whom are their top donors, to, and this is a quote, to revise their official economic platforms, all while campaigning for the nomination of the Party of the People on anti-corruption platforms. This all started right after Americans' votes were counted in 2006. Days after the election, both the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times published articles about how Democratic-affiliated corporate lobbyists were salivating at the prospect of using the new Congress to rake in legislative favors for their new clients. Quote, Democratic lobbyists are fielding calls from pharmaceutical companies, the oil and gas industry, and military companies, the Times wrote. Senior Democratic aides are now tempted to leave Capitol Hill to become lobbyists and potentially quadruple their salary. As incoming Speaker Nancy Pelosi proclaimed that election night would usher, quote, in the modest, the most honest, most open, and most ethical Congress in history, her own chief of staff was being named a, quote, K Street superstar by Business Week as he quickly transitioned to life as a lobbyist for ExxonMobil and the pharmaceutical giant Amgen. Now, this all translates into very real votes on very real issues. We can see that today. USA Today reports that this week, senators who raised millions of dollars in campaign donations from pharmaceutical interests secured industry-friendly changes to a landmark drug safety bill. This was last week. The powers granted to the FDA in the original bill draft to better inspect food and drugs in the wake of the scare over poisoned pet food, quote, were pared back during private meetings and efforts to curb conflicts of interest among FDA advisors and allow consumers to buy cheaper drugs from other countries were defeated in close votes. Now here's the crazy part. The final watered down bill, okay, after they've voted down an amendment to allow Americans to purchase lower priced FDA approved prescription drugs from Canada, from other industrialized nations, as every other industrialized nation in the world is allowed to do. Remember, we have NAFTA, but they wrote into, NAFTA's a free trade agreement, but there's a ban on Americans purchasing prescription drugs from Canada, if you can believe that. But NAFTA's a free trade agreement. So after this bill is watered down and gutted, the final vote on the bill is 93-1, a near unanimous stamp of approval of what was an entirely open and corrupt bill. I'm happy to say that my old boss, Bernie Sanders, was the one dissenter. Now, many look at what's going on and we can't believe our eyes. We sort of feel sick, nauseous. The same Democrats who were so eagerly selling out to big money interests have decent voting records in the minority. Now, how could these people, you know, how could they do this? They voted the right way in the minority. They, you know, what's going on here? But majority power, as I learned on Capitol Hill in working there, is the ultimate corruption aphrodisiac. And it's the ultimate truth serum. It's easy to vote with the people when big money interests don't need your vote. It's much more difficult to vote with the people when you are in the majority and big money interests are relying on you, pressuring you, and seducing you. For Democrats right now, the fun of being in the majority is certainly enticing. New parking spots on Capitol Hill, new titles of chairman, bigger offices, nicer curtains. But the danger for Democrats in pursuing their dishonest graft is found, I would say, in The Who's famous and cynical song, "Won't Get Fooled Again." "Meet the new boss," said Roger Daltrey, "same as the old boss." If the public begins believing that, after seeing what I've read here, that's in the newspapers all over the country, we could be watching the shortest congressional majority in modern American history. Unfortunately, this is not a problem, corruption is not a problem, of one party at one period of time. Graft, whether honest or dishonest, is built into the system itself. We scoff at developing countries for allowing rampant corruption. Our state and commerce departments tell us that in certain countries, businesses must pay government officials bribes in order to get things done. We pride ourselves on having a much cleaner and more democratic system. But the only real difference is that American corruption is codified into law. Instead of envelopes of cash, we have bundled campaign checks and PACs. Instead of shadowy hustlers that you have to hire on the black market, we have professional lobbyists. Put another way, the only difference between political corruption here in the United States and in the developing world that we look down our noses at is that here everything is simply on the books and legal, whereas elsewhere it's a black market endeavor. I would almost argue that it's worse. We're actually admitting what's going on and are totally open about it. We're so open about it, we've created a structure of laws to legalize it. At least in other countries, they're sort of embarrassed about it. You got to sort of, you know, run in the shadows to do the corruption. We live in a system of dishonest graft, one that pretends to be utterly clean under the phrases, you know, democracy and transparency, but is utterly dirty. And that's where we get to the solution of all this. What is the solution? Some people say it's, you know, the problem is money in politics. I don't think that's the problem. And some of you may not believe that. I don't think that's a problem after reading what I've just read. In a healthy democracy, you want a well-funded democracy. Taking money out of politics means that you have people can't run campaigns. They can't communicate with voters. I don't think that's what we want in this country. We want a well-funded democracy. But we don't want a democracy where the funds come with the expectation of legislative favors, specific legislative favors. That's the problem. And the only way to address that problem is to embrace public financing of elections, whereby taxpayers provide qualifying candidates money that does not come with the expectation of specific legislative favors. From Jack Abramoff to Duke Cunningham to the routine way Capitol Hill staffers trade in their public service experience in the trenches of federal buildings for lobbyists' high-priced world of ritzy steakhouses and cocktail parties, the root of the problem is money going into the system and legislative favors going out. Unless we, as a nation, invest public resources into our own democracy, we will continue to make a mockery out of our own democracy. Cities like Portland, states like Maine and Arizona and Connecticut are leading the way in this, the most basic reform. You and these other states have created successful public financing systems that have brought down campaign costs and given political opportunities to aspiring candidates who aren't just specialists in raising huge sums of money. As somebody who started out my career in politics as a lowly fundraiser in a challenger house race, it becomes very clear that the system literally recruits for the best telemarketers. I mean, the system is rigged to reward not people who have the best ideas, not people who know their communities the best, not people who are the best at even running a field campaign to meet as many voters. It is rigged to select for the people who are best at raising big sums of money. And thus we have a system that caters to big sums of money. But luckily, more states are considering making the move. And it's going to take state action. As usual, the pay-to-play culture in Washington is hostile, completely hostile, to anything that threatens it. Now, to be sure, strong public financing legislation was introduced this year in the Senate by Dick Durbin, among others. And it's absolutely true. I really want to be clear about this. There are some really courageous reformers, like Peter DeFazio, who I got to know when I worked in Congress, who have consistently stood up to big money interests, and it's not easy. The problem is, again, for every Peter DeFazio you have 10 Tom DeLays, because the system selects for that. But we have to remember that most politicians who reach Congress are masters of the existing system. And any change to that system threatens what they've mastered. The state level, of course, is far less dominated by career professional politicians. It's a level where big money certainly influences policy, but where smaller state legislatures, like Oregon's, provide an opportunity for real reform. I mean, there really is a difference between a professional politician and a non-professional politician. Ultimately, it's about who feels that they need the job to survive and who feels that the job is important, but they wouldn't jump off a bridge if they lost. I mean, everybody wants to win, but there is a big difference. And I can tell you, I mean, Montana, I mean, that's the extreme of a citizen legislature. Here we have a state where the legislature meets once every 2 years for 90 days. It's incredible. There are very good parts of it. Now, the question is, will legislators in these states take the opportunity? Now, ultimately, I'm an optimist, which I tell my friends, of course, makes me perpetually disappointed. I do think change is coming. There's only so much cynicism and anger that a democracy can take before change is forced on the system. Some people believe that cynicism and anger result only in disengagement, but change rarely comes, I would say, in linear, gradual fashion. You know, people think that people are going to get disengaged, and it just sort of goes down in a line, and people get more engaged, and it goes up in a line. I would say that it's more, I guess, to use the cliche, there's a tipping point. Things grow exponentially. Often it's more of an explosion. And just because the public may seem disengaged at one moment doesn't mean the explosion isn't right around the corner. Polls today show more Americans than ever understand just how corrupt the government is and that they're ready to fight back. Polls show that people support public financing of elections. 2 years ago, we were being told just how red and conservative America was. And then a Democratic platform of anti-corruption and economic populism swept the 2006 election. The public is disgusted with the graft and is willing to reward candidates and parties that are equally as disgusted. The party that figures out this truism washes its hands of both honest and dishonest graft and pursues a real reform agenda is the party, I would say, that will dominate American politics in a more thorough way than George Washington Plunkett's Tammany Hall and its modern-day successors in Washington, D.C. ever dream. I really do believe that. I can't give you a date when this tipping point is going to happen. But what I can tell you in traveling around the country and researching my book and talking to a lot of people and organizing state legislators through the Progressive States Network, which I am a part of, that something big is coming. And this state really has a chance to lead the way. It has a chance to lead the way on public financing of elections. It has a chance to lead the way on what I said in my op-ed today about fusion voting. Fusion voting is an absolutely critical reform that some of the most corrupt states in the country have used to fight back against this. I started talking about Tammany Hall, New York City. New York State is one of the most money-dominated political cultures in America, probably is the most money-dominated political culture in America. But they have a system that allows small parties to endorse to cross-endorse on the ballot different candidates from different parties. So when, for instance, Chuck Schumer runs for Senate, he's often listed on the Democratic Party line and the Working Families Party line. And what that does is that allows, the Working Families Party is defined on economic populist issues. So when people vote for Chuck Schumer on the Working Families Party line, they send him a message saying, we want you to focus on core working class economic issues. And the flip side of that is that when Chuck Schumer goes to Washington and sells out working class economic issues, there is the threat that the Working Families Party will endorse somebody else and take votes away from him. This is power politics. Going after the nexus of money that goes into the system with the expectation of legislative favors, going after that nexus is the ultimate form of power politics. You are challenging the system, whether it's through fusion voting or whether it's through public financing of elections. So this is going to be a very, very difficult fight. But I would say to everyone in closing, we all get excited about individual issues. You know, I happen to be very, very interested in trade, as I said. Some people are very interested in wages. Some people are interested in global warming. Some people are interested in other parts of environmental policy. What I am talking about now affects all of these issues. If we don't fix this, every reform that comes on every other individual issue will likely be at the margins. You cannot, I mean, I was talking to somebody earlier today. We have a system where literally a president of the United States can be reelected on a platform where almost all of his major issues are what I would call 20% issues. Issues where 20% of the population supports him. Social Security privatization, the, you know, energy policy, you name it. Now Iraq. So we have a system where a person who's defined by 20% issues is able somehow to win elections. That should say something about whether our democracy is working. And I would submit that the problem, the disconnect there, has everything to do with big money. So I want to thank everybody for coming here, and I most importantly want to urge you, when you leave here tonight, do whatever you can, whether it's contacting your state legislator, whether it's talking to your U.S. senators, your U.S. congresspeople, tell them that this issue is the most important issue to you. Whether you, your main policy issue in your own head is any one of the number that I've laid out here. Because this will only come when politicians feel that there will be a price if they don't act. Thank you very much.
On behalf of all of us, I want to thank David, and we've got plenty of time for questions, and then books to be signed in the back if you're interested in reading, and I think you should, Hostile Takeover. And I also want to thank David with this Something to Remember Portland from, this blanket by made by Pendleton Woolen Mills. I had a hard time deciding on this blanket because there's another pattern called the Geronimo pattern, where Geronimo was never a chief, but he was the fiercest fighter for the Apache, and I think it would have been a good one, but I just like this look better, so that's what we went with. But I think this is our political Geronimo here.
Thank you. And I should say one other thing. I'm happy to sign books afterwards, and I expect everybody here to buy at least five. Yes. The left side is a list of parties. Okay? Democrat, Republican, Party A, Party B, Party C, whatever they are. The top axis, okay, is the list of offices. Senate, Congress, Governor, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so it's a grid. So, let's say it's this time. Republican, on the Republican line, that's what they call them, on the Republican line, under U.S. Senate Gordon Smith. Okay? Boo. Now, let's say that there's a conservative party that loves Gordon Smith, some right-wing lunatic party, right? The right-wing lunatic party of Oregon, okay? They focus only on right-wing lunatic issues, as if they're different from the Republican Party. There you go. They are on the ballot under the Republican Party, let's say. Go over to Senate, and they list Gordon Smith as well. If you vote for Gordon Smith on the lunatic line, he still gets your vote. Okay? So now you've basically created a system that allows third parties to be on the ballot without forcing, in most cases, when they fuse, without forcing you to make an either-or decision. You get to send a message based on the small part, the minor party, or the third party's branding. And most of the fusion parties in New York have branded themselves very narrowly because of this. So the Working Families Party, which is a great model, great people, they are doing great work, they have branded themselves specifically on economic issues. Their mail, when you get mail from the Working Families Party, it will say, vote for Chuck Schumer on the Working Families Party line, tell him you want him to focus on raising the minimum wage. Now, obviously, every now and again, the smaller parties will use their leverage to actually endorse somebody else when they feel that their agenda has not been respected. This has been used masterfully in New York. And here's how you know it. They had a Republican governor and a Republican state senate and a Democratic house. They passed the legislature, both houses, passed a minimum wage increase, which the Republican governor vetoed. The Working Families Party used its endorsement as a tool to leverage the Republican Senate's to override their own Republican governor's veto of minimum wage legislation. Now, just think about that for a second, okay? Minimum wage is not really a Republican issue. And that's an understatement. So a Republican Senate overrode their own Republican governor on a very, very progressive issue because of the leveraging of endorsements by a minor party. And I'm not making this up. This is, you know, the New York Times, the, you know, Newsday, all that. This is widely known in New York. So this creates leverage for people and small parties that know where the major issues are. And I think it is one of the ways where our elections become a little bit less about the individual personalities on the ballot and a little bit more about the issues. Because I like that mainly because as much as I love certain individual politicians, Peter DeFazio, Bernie Sanders, et cetera, et cetera, most of these politicians are vessels. They are vessels. They do not lead. They respond to pressure. That's what they are. And so I would rather, in most cases, 99% of cases, have elections that are based on issues, understanding that whoever the politician is merely a vessel for that issue. Yes?
In states like Oregon, where we can decide by ballot measure to have fusion voting, I mean, we have an option that other states don't have. And for those states, it feels like the fox is guarding the hen house. Our politicians are in charge of voting on these campaign finance measures. So as a whole, when we have this system, besides fusion voting, what options do you see that we have?
It's a tough question. And one last thing I want to say about fusion before I get to the question. Fusion, by the way, was legal in every state in the country up until the turn of the 19th century. Every state in the country was legal. The famous quote was from the Minnesota legislature, where a legislator who was basically owned by the railroad companies at that time basically said, his famous quote is, "We can deal with you he would say, you, the Democrat, you know, the Minnesota Party is the Democratic Farmer Labor Party. We can deal with you, you being Democrats, farmers, labor union people. We can deal with you each individually. It is the fusion we detest. So this was broken up because it was allowing different disempowered segments to come together. What else can a place like Oregon do other than public financing of elections, other than fusion? Well, I would say, first of all, if you can do those two, you're a hell of a lot farther along than most everywhere else. I would say that the other things you can do, you've done a very good job of, I think, increasing voter turnout. I think that's a huge issue. I think vote by mail does that. I think that's a very, very big, big step. I've heard, I don't know where I stand really on the issue of ballot measures. I know that they can be sort of pretty easily abused and they can cause all sorts of problems. They've caused some problems in Montana. I think the idea that this state doesn't have campaign contribution limits is atrocious. I think that's it's embarrassing. I mean, here's why you should feel embarrassed about that. Texas has campaign contribution limits. Yeah, and I think somebody told me that corporations are allowed to donate straight to parties or straight to candidates. That's what Tom DeLay might go to jail over, and that's allowed here. So I would say that, you know, that's a really big issue. But then again, if you get public financing of elections, then, you know, campaign contribution limits become less important. Still important, but less important. Because remember, you know, as everybody probably knows here, you know, you can't have a binding public financing system. It has to be voluntary based on Supreme Court rulings on free speech. Yes?
How do you get the media and groups like MoveOn.org to pay attention to some of these smaller parties? Because it seems like one of the problems is they're never recognized, and there's sort of this, if we don't support the Democrats, it's going to be the Republicans.
That's a good question. Let me say, I am not a... I think third parties as they exist in the current system often do more harm than good. Now, I don't think third parties in general do more harm than good. I think under the current system, they have been locked into a place where they can primarily only do more harm than good. So, you know, your question about why does Move On basically ignore third parties? My answer is because I think they're making not a stupid political calculation that under the current system, third parties can primarily be destructive. I think a better question, if I can throw it out there, is why hasn't Move On and other groups focused on creating a system where third parties can play a really productive role? Fusion, instant runoff voting. I mean, that's a good question. And I think the answer to that, now I'm not talking specifically about Move On because there could be other, but why isn't this more front burner? Because obviously, who does it threaten? It threatens the existing parties, or it could threaten the existing parties. I mean, here's the thing if you talk to your legislators about fusion, because fusion really does have a chance of passing here. It hasn't passed the legislature. It's passed one of the houses. It's in the Senate right now, I believe. The issue is Democrats are afraid that it will hurt them. And that's not 100% unfounded. It could. There are stories in New York, the famous Working Families Party story in New York is when you had it's a pretty amazing story. You had the district attorney of Albany, which is a very important position in New York because its jurisdiction is the legislature, so it gets to go after, you know, corrupt legislators. Very powerful position. District attorney there was awful on the Rockefeller drug laws, if folks know what that, you know, the mandatory sentencing. And the Working Families Party ran a little-known guy against him in an either-or situation, not a fusion situation, and beat him. And it sent shockwaves through the whole Democratic Party in New York. So there is reason for what I would call institutional Democrats to be afraid of fusion. However, if you talk to your senators, what you should tell them, and if they're Democrats, what you should tell them is that the Working Families Party has been able to make its biggest impact in helping Democrats get voters they would not have gotten in places that they have not competed before. Best example, on Long Island, there was a Republican district that was Republican for, I think, 40 years. And this guy ran against the Republican congressman. Everyone thought he had no chance. He ends up winning by 3,000 votes. I'm going to mess up the numbers a little bit here. Ends up winning by 3,000 votes. And he got, I think, 4,000 votes or 6,000 votes on the Working Families Party line. And by doing the math backwards, they found that he got about 3,500 votes on the Working Families Party line, voters who also voted for George Pataki. Now think about that. Republican for governor, I'm not voting for the Democrat on the Democratic line, I'm not going to vote for the Republican on the Republican congressional line, I'm voting for the Democrat on the Working Families Party line. And they would tell you that that's because in New York, in places like Long Island, you want to give people a way to vote for the Democrat without, in that state, having it have to come with the mental baggage of Hillary Clinton and Manhattan liberals. And so if you want to think about a way for Democrats to start getting some rural and eastern Oregon voters, this is one of the ways to do it. Yes?
As I understand it, the principal motivation for fusion voting is to give third parties a bit of an influence, but it does not allow them to have their own candidates elected.
It's not true.
That's
not true.
You're voting for a third. You're voting for a primary candidate who's also on the minor party ticket. Is that right?
You are voting for, in the general election and in the primary, they can put on whoever they want. The point is that fusion allows, the other term for fusion is cross endorsement. Okay, so one party can have the same name on their line that another party can have on. Now you're right in there is one issue you're touching on, which is the primary, which gets very interesting, very, very interesting. In districts where the Democrats or the Republicans have a lock, a safe district in the general, there is a fierce competition for the endorsement of the fusion party for the, you know, in that primary. And I think that is where, in New York, the Working Families Party has really also been able to leverage itself. But they can endorse whoever they want. They can run through. That's how the guy in Albany won.
I'm sorry if I misunderstood. But I'd like to hear your opinion on instant runoff voting, IRV, which more directly, it seems to me, allows a candidate to have a shot at winning the election without having people feel that they're jeopardizing their vote.
I think instant runoff voting is a good thing. I think anything that improves democracy is a good thing. The only reason I would say, not the only reason, but the major reason why I think fusion is more important is because you can leverage the major parties a little bit better. You can hold them accountable, exactly. Instant runoff voting is sort of, it's not either or, obviously, but the power of fusion is to get the major party candidates to be worried. That's ultimately what politics really is all about. I actually think that, this is part of my new book, is that progressives often forget about this. We like to make people feel good and be nice and be positive. Politics is not a positive or nice place. The only time things happen in politics is when politicians get scared to death. Yes.
So earlier in your talk, you
seem to be denigrating the fact that we could have somebody who is elected by 20%, 20%, 20%. And I'm really not understanding how fusion voting is anything other than a shell game that gives us 20%, 20%, 20%. So perhaps you could differentiate those for me.
Sure. Fusion voting doesn't allow somebody to win with 20% of the vote. You still have to win with 50 plus one. It's because fusion allows votes for the same candidate on different party lines to go to the same candidate. Third party, to be honest, the current system actually allows, is more prone to what you would call, I guess, plurality rule. If you have either or voting, somebody can win an election with 30% of the vote. Literally, they can win an election. I mean, at least George Bush won with 50% plus one of the people who voted, or theoretically he did, in 2004. To qualify my statement so many times with that election. He won 50% plus one, theoretically, only in 2004. But the point is that the current system is the one, if you had a, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton, right, in 1992, what he won the presidency with 42% of the vote? You know, that to me, that's even worse than, you know, that's the example of what I'm talking about. Yes.
Well, you're talking about the campaign expenses and the efforts by the different organizations to collect for the party. But my mailbox is full, is coming in, plus telephone calls, and I can't even keep track of the Democratic groups that are recruiting and how important, you know, this election 2008 is going to be. How do we really differentiate between these groups?
That's a good question. You know, again, I don't think we want necessarily less spending. Let me qualify that. There's a certain amount of spending that I think we want, and I think it should be a healthy amount. I don't think the problem is necessarily that too much in a vacuum is being spent. I mean, in a vacuum, we want as much communication, as much engagement as possible. How do you differentiate? I don't want to sound like a broken record. Fusion is one way that people can differentiate. You walk into the ballot. If you know anything about the parties, then the ballot actually helps you differentiate. Oh, I know, I trust the Working Families Party. I know that they're really into these core economic issues. So who they've endorsed, that's an important, maybe not decisive, maybe it is decisive. That's an important piece of information for me. That's one way. I think the other way, and this is a big problem, is that the media is supposed to help us differentiate. Supposed to. And that hasn't happened. And so, but I do think that with the rise of the internet, I think that the diversification of, I shouldn't say diversification, the multiplication of different media voices, it's not necessarily more diverse and we still have ownership issues, but allows us to have more people asking more questions. The problem is that it becomes a flood of information. So I don't have any good answers other than to say, broadly, you've got to find out who do you trust and then use that avenue that you trust as your prism. If it's on a fusion ballot, then maybe you trust one of the fusion parties. If it's certain writers, then maybe you trust certain writers. You've got to basically figure out who you trust, which is not easy. Okay, one more. Yes.
Would you help us sort out amongst the Democrat organizations that came to mind as the last lady was asking a question? Make a comment, please, about the Democrat Leadership Conference, the Democrat Congressional Campaign Fund, the senatorial, the Democrat senatorial campaign fund, and the Democrat National Committee.
Differentiate between all those. Okay, here we go. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, and the Democratic National Committee are all basically the same. They are a bank account. That's what they are. They are a glorified bank account. I would put an asterisk next to the DNC because I think Howard Dean is trying to do new tactics with a 50-state strategy, as he calls it. Now, that is tactically new. Tactically. Should you think different ideologically or policy-wise about a candidate because you got a DNC mailer rather than a DCCC mailer rather than a DSCC mailer? No. They are like a, you know how like a corporation has a fiduciary responsibility to do anything it can to maximize profit? The DNC, the DSCC, the DCCC, and on the other side, the RNC, the NRSC, and the NRCC, they are politics version of a corporation. They are there to elect any kind of Democrat and or any kind of Republican, no matter what, period, end of story. The same National Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee spent lots of money trying to reelect Lincoln Chafee, actually a moderate Republican, unlike Gordon Smith, in Rhode Island. At the same time, they were trying to aggressively reelect Rick Santorum, who's slightly to the right of Genghis Khan. The Democratic Leadership Council is a different kind of organization. They are an ideological organization. They are funded by organizations, companies, Enron, DuPont, et cetera, et cetera. They are designed to try to, very overtly really, to help make a faction of the, peel off a faction of the Democratic Party to help Republicans on economic issues. That's the most sort of crass way to put it. Where is the progressive pull on that? Where is the progressive organization? You certainly have Move On. And I'm not singling Move On out. They're a great organization, but there's many other organizations. But I do think it's important for people to really try to figure out which organizations they can trust. There are a lot of different organizations out there. I realize that it's really confusing. But with a little bit of research, you know, the problem with the internet is it creates a flood of information, but allows you to get a lot of information if you're willing to take some time to study it. I have suggested to people, find the writers that you trust. Find the specific reporters in specific papers that you believe aren't biased and have delivered accurate information. And read them and understand that and trust them. It's not easy to do, but in a ever-increasingly complex media world, we are headed towards a system where people are really going to have to figure out who they trust. It's almost like we're going back to the turn of the century when we had what was called the penny press, right? We had newspapers that were overtly ideological, and we still see the remnants of this in newspapers' names like the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, for instance. So you read that knowing where they were coming from. And I actually don't think that that's necessarily bad. Frankly, I would rather get my information from somebody who acknowledges to me what their agenda, what their outlook is, rather than people who pretend they have no outlook or agenda when clearly...